had to submit to her sovereignty, depend upon her for their next breath. They were owned by drunkards, such as Lilburn Lewis of Livingston County, Kentucky, who once chopped a slave to bits with an axe, Stamp wrote, and by sadists, such as Madame Lalaurie of New Orleans, who tortured her slaves for her own amusement. In order to survive, they were to give way to the most wretched white man, observed the Farmer's Register of 1834. For much of the time that African Americans have been in this land, they have had to find ways to stay alive in a structure that required total submission, a close reading of their betters, and the performance of that submission in order to avoid savage punishment. They must obey at all times and under all circumstances, cheerfully and with alacrity, said a Virginia slaveholder. They had to adjust themselves to the shifting and arbitrary demands of whatever dominant person they happened to be encountering in that moment. This created a nerve-jangling existence, given that any number of acts, according to a North Carolina judge during the time of slavery, could be read as insolence, whether it was a look, the pointing of a finger, a refusal or neglect to step out of the way when a white person is seen to approach. To these, the 19th century orator Frederick Douglass added the following gestures that could incite white rage and violence. In the tone of an answer, Douglass wrote, in answering at all, in not answering, in the expression of countenance, in the motion of the head, in the gait, manner, and bearing. Any one of these, if tolerated, would destroy that subordination upon which our social system rests, the North Carolina judge said. This code extended for generations. Years after the Nazis were defeated across the Atlantic, African Americans were still being brutalized for the least appearance of stepping out of their place. Planters routinely whipped their sharecroppers for trivial offenses, wrote Allison Davis and Burley and Mary Gardner in 1941. A planter in Mississippi said that if his tenant didn't stop acting so big, the next time it would be the bullet or a rope. That is the way to manage them when they get too big. In 1948, a black tenant farmer in Louise, Mississippi, was severely beaten by two whites, wrote the historian James C. Cobb, because he asked for a receipt after paying his water bill. The most trivial interaction had to be managed with ranking in mind. Well into the 1960s in the American South, the mere boarding of a public bus was a tightly choreographed affair devised for maximum humiliation and stigma to the lowest caste. Unlike dominant caste passengers who climbed aboard, paid their bus fare, and took a seat, black passengers had to climb up, pay their fare, then get off the bus so as not to pollute or disturb the white section by walking through it. Having been forced to disembark after paying, they then had to run to the back door of the bus to board in the colored section. It was not uncommon for the bus to drive off before they could make it to the back door. The passengers who had the least room for error, the least resources to lose the benefit of the ticket they had paid for, the least cushion to weather a setback, would now be humiliated as the bus pulled off without them, now likely to arrive late for work, thus putting already tenuous jobs at further risk. The Negro occupies a position of inferiority and servility, of which he is constantly reminded when traveling, by restriction and by the attitudes of his white neighbors, wrote the historian Bertram Doyle. The laws and protocols kept them both apart and low. The greater the chasm, the easier to distance and degrade, the easier to justify any injustice or depravity. The human meaning of caste for those who live it is power and vulnerability, privilege and oppression, honor and denigration, plenty and want, reward and deprivation, security and anxiety, wrote the preeminent American scholar of caste, Gerald Berryman. A description of caste which fails to convey this is a travesty. In the slaveholding South, some in the dominant caste grew so accustomed to the embedded superiority built into their days and the brutality that it took to maintain it, that they wondered how they might manage in the afterlife. "Is it possible that any of my slaves could go to heaven?" a dominant caste woman in South Carolina asked her minister. "And I must see them there." A century after the slaveholder spoke those words, the caste system had survived and mutated, its pillars intact. America was fighting in World War II, and the public school district in Columbus, Ohio, decided to hold an essay contest, challenging students to consider the question, what to do with Hitler after the war? It was the spring of 1944, the same year that a black boy was forced to jump to his death, in front of his stricken father, over the Christmas card the boy had sent to a white girl at work. In that atmosphere, a 16-year-old African-American girl thought about what should befall Hitler. She won the student essay contest with a single sentence: "Put him in a black skin and let him live the rest of his life in America." Part 4. The Tentacles of Caste. Brown Eyes versus Blue Eyes. The third graders fidgeted in their seats and rested their chins on their folded forearms as their teacher, Mrs. Elliott, told them the rules of a class experiment she wanted to try with them. This was in the farm town of Riceville, Iowa, in the late 1960s, and all of the children, the descendants of immigrants from Germany and Scotland and Ireland and Scandinavia, had roughly the same skin color as their teacher, and from afar, little by which to distinguish one from another. But after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and the turmoil that followed beyond the cornfields that surrounded them, Jane Elliott decided she needed to do something out of the ordinary to teach her dominant caste students how it felt to be judged on the basis of an arbitrary physical trait, the color of their eyes. She announced to the children that they would do things differently that day. She laid out arbitrary stereotypes for a neutral trait that, for now, in her classroom, would put a student with that trait in essentially the lowest caste. She told the children that brown-eyed people are not as good as blue-eyed people, that they are slower than blue-eyed people, not as smart as blue-eyed people, that until she said otherwise, the brown-eyed students would not be allowed to drink from the water fountain, that they had to use paper cups instead. She told the children that the brown-eyed people could not play with the blue-eyed people on the playground and would have to come in early, but that the blue-eyed students would get to stay out longer for recess. The students looked confused at first. Then, in a matter of minutes, a caste hierarchy formed. It started as soon as the teacher told the children to open their books to a certain page to begin their lesson. "Everyone ready?" Mrs. Elliott asked the class. One little girl was still turning the pages in her book to get to the right one. The teacher looked at the girl, her eyes judging and impatient. "Everyone but Lori," Mrs. Elliott said with exasperation. "Ready, Lori?" A blue-eyed boy interjected. "She's a brown-eyed," he said, having caught on instantly to the significance of what had never mattered for as long as he had known the girl. When lunchtime approached, the teacher told the blue-eyed children they would get to eat first and would be permitted a second helping, but the brown-eyed children weren't allowed to. "They might take too much," the teacher told them. The brown-eyed children looked downcast and defeated. One boy got into a fight at recess because one of the blue-eyed boys had called him a name. "What did he call you?" the teacher asked him. Brown eyes, the boy said, tears at the surface of those eyes. An otherwise neutral trait had been converted into a disability. The teacher later switched roles, and the blue-eyed children became the scapegoat caste, with the same caste behavior that had arisen the day before between these artificially constructed upper and lower castes. "Seems when we were down on the bottom, everything bad was happening to us," one girl said. "The way you're treated, you felt like you didn't want to try to do anything," said another. Classroom performance fell for both groups of students during the few hours that they were relegated to the subordinate caste. The brown-eyed students took twice as long to finish a phonics exercise the day that they were made to feel inferior. "I watched my students become what I told them they were," she told NBC News decades later. When the brown-eyed children were put on a pedestal and made dominant, Elliot told the network she saw little wonderful brown-eyed white people become vicious, ugly, nasty, discriminating, domineering people in the space of 15 minutes. With the blue-eyed children scapegoated and subordinated, "I watched brilliant blue-eyed white Christian children become timid and frightened and angry and unable to learn in the space of 15 minutes," she said. "If you do that with a whole group of people for a lifetime," she said, "you change them psychologically. You convince those who are analogous to the brown-eyed people that they are superior, that they are perfect, that they have the right to rule. And you convince those who take the place of the blue-eyed students that they are less than. If you do that for a lifetime, what do you suppose that does to them?" Chapter 10. Central Miscasting. I arrived in London on a slate gray morning in December 2017 for a major conference on the topic that had begun to consume my waking hours: caste. Unlike many events I attend, I was going there to listen, to gain a greater understanding of that which I did not know, rather than to speak myself. I would be surrounded by people who studied what seemed to be the missing codes to human ruptures. The issue of caste was, to my mind, the basis of every other ism. These researchers were now my intellectual tribe. These were people who could see past the hierarchies and false divisions that undermined the species. The auditorium was packed with sociologists, political scientists, anthropologists, graduate students, and I could barely contain myself as I took a seat in the front. A woman who appeared to be of East Asian descent removed her jacket and nodded. There was no flinching or scooting away. There were no quizzical side eyes, as might happen in a similar setting in the States. I was feeling better already. I took a measure of the crowd and noticed that here at the crossroads of the world, there was no one else at the conference who looked like me. Most everyone appeared to be descended from South Asia, meaning India, or from Europe, primarily the United Kingdom. Not one person of African descent, from what I could tell, only two or three Americans, all of them white and based in Europe or India. I alone had crossed the Atlantic for the single day of attempting to understand the forces that had shaped the course of my life and those of my ancestors and of many other people before me. While I had studied the unspoken caste structure in the United States, I had not yet spent time on the original caste system of India. As with many conversations about injustice, the talks turned almost exclusively on the victims and consequences of societal ills, rather than on their origins. Panel after panel looked through a different lens at the suffering of the lowest castes, which in India have been called the scheduled castes, or, shocking to American ears, the backward castes. I began to see parallels with America, heard stories that could have been taken from the headlines in the United States about African Americans and indigenous people. Both countries had abolished legal discrimination, and yet, according to the panels and keynotes, Dalits were being brutalized by Indian authorities, as African Americans were being brutalized by police in the United States. And a people known as the Adivasi were fighting to retain their lands and culture in India, as have the indigenous people in America. Two different countries, oceans apart, had found parallel ways to contain the subordinate groups within them. I could close my eyes, change the names as I listened to these reports, and feel that I was back in the United States. Another Dalit murdered by police, another Adivasi murdered by the police, a woman said. Why do we not face up to the outrage of state-sanctioned violence? At the first break, I was anxious to get a copy of the papers the scholars had read that morning. I had decided early on that I was not going to lean on any recognition that might accrue to me from my first book. In fact, I purposely kept a quiet profile so as not to attract attention to this new project that was then still germinating in my head. I was there on the strength of my own personal presentation, there to be accepted for what people could see, a well-dressed woman, an American, an African-American, well-spoken, and focused. I went up to a professor, an Indian woman, an upper caste woman, as I would come to realize, who seemed to be in charge. I asked if I might get a copy of the papers that were presented. Would they be made available? She said no. You'll have to wait. Why do you need a copy? I'm a writer, and I've come all the way from America just for this, I told her. I thought that this level of dedication might impress her. It did not. She directed me to an Englishman who was her senior, and it seemed that even here among people who studied caste, there might be traditional hierarchy at work. The woman was then pulled away by the press of people, and the Englishman was swamped as well. As in any human grouping, there were cliques and fraternities of people who had known one another or worked together, and rather than an open conference, this was starting to feel like a family reunion to which I had been admitted by accident. At the lunch break, I spotted a gentleman who was sitting alone across from other men who were talking to one another. He was Indian, like three-quarters of the attendees, but he was different. He was carrying a black briefcase, all business and purposeful amid the backpacks surrounding us. Like me, he seemed an outsider among insiders. I felt an immediate kinship. His name, he told me as I took a seat next to him, was Tushar. He was born in Bengal and was a geologist now living in London. He was more formally dressed than everyone else. Blue Oxford shirt collar peeking above his gray tweed jacket, a side part in his thick gray hair, his eyes smiling in quarter moons on his warm, kind face as he talked. According to the caste system, he said, as if informing me of the status of someone he once knew, I belonged to the second upper caste, the warrior soldier caste. I looked at this man who was not much taller than I, small-boned, narrow-shouldered, gentle of face, self-effacingly modest in bearing, and wondered on what planet would this man be seen as a natural-born warrior. Here was living proof of the miscasting of caste. This had long ago registered to him as well, and he took the caste ascription with so little solemnity that he was not at first able to give the exact spelling of the caste, or in Sanskrit, the varna to which he was born. I did not yet know the four varnas at the time, or that castes were even called varnas, so I asked him to write it down for me. He wrote the words Kshatriya and then Kshatriyas in my notepad. I think it is kshatriya, he said, as if to disregard its significance by misremembering how to spell or pronounce it. It's an issue not well understood. I was raised with social privilege. You are told you are second upper caste, the ruling caste, and that you are to be happy that there are many below you. But as a young boy on the way to school, he passed the beggars on the streets asking for money and people crying out that they had no food. His own family sat down to meals with 4 or 5 courses, dal and amaranth, mutton and chutney, while less well-off families subsisted on rice and potatoes, and those beneath them on even less. It was hard to enjoy one's privilege when so few people had it. When he was 11 or 12, he began asking why his family had so much and others so little. Don't discuss about these things, the elders told him. Do your studies. Caste is created by God. The afternoon sessions were about to begin, discussions of Dalit protests and corporate encroachment on the land of the Adivasis. Tushar and I headed back to the auditorium, each of us on our respective missions. As this was England, there was a break for tea, and I gravitated to Tushar again in the crowd. He looked forlorn and impatient now. They haven't answered my questions, he said. All my life I have lived with this. I am looking for answers about how this began. I will stay to hear more. He asked me why I had come all the way from America for this conference. I told him I wanted to understand caste because I lived with it too. I told him most people don't think of America as having a caste system, but it has all the hallmarks of one. He listened and did not judge. Caste defines everything in India, he said. It is the Hindu religion that maintains the caste system. That is why Ambedkar became a Buddhist. It was not an escape for him. It was a liberation. Casteism is another form of racism. God knows how long it will take for people to let it go. I'm wondering, then, are you still a Hindu? I asked him. I am atheist, he said. No religion since I was 13. What does your family think of that? They think you are born a Hindu, you die a Hindu. You do not escape caste. But I believe what I believe. Who cares what they think? He appeared to have given some consideration to what I had told him about the hierarchy in America. It had puzzled him and intrigued him. If you have caste in the U.S., he asked me, where are you in the caste system? That is the question that many Indians ask, in one form or another, upon meeting a fellow Indian. It is a line of inquiry that those in the lowest caste know is coming and that they dread. Indians will ask the surname, the occupation of one's father, the village one is from, the section of the village that one is from, to suss out the caste of whoever is in front of them. They will not rest until they have uncovered the person's rank in the social order. Tushar had waited quite some time to ask me this, and would not likely have done so or thought of it at all if I hadn't mentioned caste in America. The idea seemed a wonderment to him. He seemed to want to know how things worked, and where I fit into what, to him, was an alien hierarchy. I had not expected this question. Nobody had ever asked me before. How could he not know? Was he merely being polite? Hollywood and the news media have exported demeaning images of African Americans for generations, which means our reputations often precede us, and not for the better. So I was, in fact, strangely grateful for his giving me an option. Even without the language of caste, most any American would know the ranking of the group to which I was born. But here was a man born upper caste in India and a skeptic of inherited status, seeing me as an individual who might be of any rank. He was not putting me in a box, nor making the assumptions that I labor under every day. His question was liberating in its innocent lack of judgment, yet it brought to mind Dr. King's epiphany nearly 60 years before in India. "Well," I told Tushar, "in America, I am assigned to the lowest caste, the American untouchables. I am an American Dalit, and I am living proof that caste is artificial." He gave a look of recognition. My answer was further confirmation of what he considered a disease. We would have other conversations in the following months whenever I visited London. He would share more of the absurdities he had witnessed in the caste system back home. He remembered the Dalit students whose exams went ungraded. "The tests were not marked," he said, "because the teacher was upper caste and would not touch the paper touched by a Dalit. So you laugh or you cry." He told me about the upper caste woman in an office where he once worked. She would get up from her desk and walk the length of the office, down the hall and around the corner, to ask a Dalit to get her water. "The jug was there next to her desk," he said. "The Dalit had to come to where she was sitting and pour it for her. It was beneath her dignity to get the water herself from the desk beside her. This is the sickness of caste." He recalled the heartbreak of the Indian fixation on skin color, which was caste within caste, and the hatred of darker Indians, who tend to be lower caste, but not always, and how they suffer for this accident of fate, as do African Americans and other people of color in the United States and in other parts of the world. His older sister happened to be darker than most of his siblings, and when she reached courting age, she was told she would have to boil milk and skim the skin from the boiled milk and spread it on her face prior to sleep every night before the young men came to interview her for marriage. "Imagine," he said, "week after week, night after night, she knew she would be rejected, and she would close the door to her room and cry. I was 12. I remember to this day. She got married, but that's not the point. She should not have to go through all of this, the cruelty of it." We had both been miscast, each in our own way, and could see through the delusion that had shaped and restricted us from the other side of our respective caste systems. We had broken from the matrix and were convinced that we could see what others could not, and that others could see it too, if they could awaken from their slumber. We had defied our caste assignments. He was not a warrior or ruler. He was a geologist. I was not a domestic. I was an author. He had defied his caste from on high, and I from below. And we had met at this moment in London at our own Maginot line of equality, standing on different sides of the same quest to understand the forces that had sought to define us, but had failed. Chapter 11. Dominant Group Status Threat and the Precarity of the Highest Rung. In late 2015, two economists at Princeton University announced the startling revelation that the death rates of middle-aged white Americans, especially less educated white Americans at midlife, had risen for the first time since 1950. The perplexing results of this study on mortality rates in the United States sounded alarms on the front pages of newspapers and at the top of news feeds across the nation. The surge in early deaths among middle-aged white people went counter to the trends of every other ethnic group in America. Even historically marginalized Black and Latino Americans had seen their mortality rates fall during the time period studied, from 1998 to 2013. The rise in the white death rate was at odds with prevailing trends in the rest of the Western world. Americans had enjoyed increasing longevity the previous century with each succeeding generation, due to healthier lifestyles and advancements in medicine. But starting just before the turn of the 21st century, the death rates among middle-aged white Americans ages 45 to 54 began to rise, as the least educated in particular succumbed to suicide, drug overdoses, and liver disease from alcohol abuse, according to the authors of the seminal study, Anne Case and the Nobel laureate Angus Deaton. These deaths of despair, as the economists called them, accounted for the loss of some 500,000 white Americans during that period, more than the number of American soldiers who died during World War II. These are people who might still be alive had this group kept to previous generational trends. These are deaths that do not have to happen, Case said at a conference on inequality. These are people who are taking their lives, either slowly or quickly. The worsening numbers were persistent and large enough to drive up white mortality rates overall and to outweigh the gains in longevity from advances in the treatment of cancer and heart disease. The turnabout reversed decades of progress in mortality and was unique to the United States, Case and Deaton wrote. No other rich country saw a similar turnaround. For this group of Americans, mortality rates rose at a time when rates in other Western countries had not merely dipped, but had plummeted. The rate for middle-aged white Americans rose from about 375 per 100,000 people in the late 1990s to about 415 per 100,000 in 2013, as against a fall in the United Kingdom, for example, from about 330 per 100,000 to 260 per 100,000 over the same period. A graphic of the mortality rates for leading Western nations shows an upward line for the death rates of middle-aged white Americans against the plunging lines for their counterparts in fellow Western countries. What could account for the worsening prospects of this group of Americans, unique in the Western world and singular even in the United States? The authors noted that since the 1970s, real wages had stagnated for blue-collar workers, leading to economic insecurity and to a generation less well-off than previous ones. But they acknowledged that similar stagnation had occurred in other Western countries. They noted that comparable Western countries had a more generous safety net that could offer protections not available in the United States. Yet white Americans would not be the only group affected by wage stagnation and a thin safety net. Blue-collar workers of other backgrounds would be equally at risk from the uncertainties of the economy, if not more so. Black death rates had been historically higher than those of other groups, but even their mortality rates were falling year by year. It was white Americans at midlife who were dying of despair in rising numbers. In caste terms, these are the least well-off, most precariously situated members of the dominant caste in America. For generations, they could take for granted their inherited rank in the hierarchy and the benefits that accrued from it. We may underestimate, though, the aftershocks of a shift in demographics, the erosion of labor unions, the perceived loss of status, the fears about their place in the world, and resentment that the kind of security their fathers could rely upon might now be waning in what were supposed to be the best years of their lives. Rising immigration from across the Pacific and the Rio Grande and the ascendance of a black man as president made for an inversion of the world as many had known it, and some of them might have been more susceptible to the calls to take our country back after 2008 and to make America great again in 2016. In America, political scientists have given this malaise of insecurities a name: dominant group status threat. This phenomenon is not the usual form of prejudice or stereotyping, that involves looking down on outgroups who are perceived to be inferior, writes Diana Mutz, a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. Instead, it is born of a sense that the outgroup is doing too well and thus is a viable threat to one's own dominant group status. The victims of these deaths of despair are in the same category of people whom centuries ago the colonial elites elevated as they created the caste system. The planters bestowed higher status on European yeomen and those of the lower classes to create a new American category known as white. In earlier times, even those who owned no slaves, wrote the white Southern author W.J. Cash, clung to the dear treasure of his superiority as a white man, which had been conferred on him by slavery, and so was determined to keep the black man in chains. By the middle of the 20th century, the white working-class American, wrote the white Southern author Lillian Smith, has not only been neglected and exploited, he has been fed little except the scraps of skin color and white supremacy as spiritual nourishment. Working-class whites, the preeminent social economist Gunnar Myrdal wrote, need the demarcations of caste more than upper-class whites. They are the people likely to stress aggressively that no Negro can ever attain the status of even the lowest white. In a psychic way, the people dying of despair could be said to be dying of the end of an illusion, an awakening to the holes in an article of faith that an inherited, unspoken superiority, a natural deservedness over subordinated castes, would assure their place in the hierarchy. They had relied on this illusion, perhaps beyond the realm of consciousness, and perhaps needed it more than any other group in a forbiddingly competitive society in which downward social mobility was a constant fear, the historian David Roediger wrote. One might lose everything, but not whiteness. In the midst of the Great Depression, the scholar W.E.B. Du Bois observed that working-class white Americans had bought into the compensation of a public and psychological wage, as he put it. They were given public deference and titles of courtesy because they were white. They had accepted the rough uncertainties of laboring-class life in exchange for the caste system's guarantee that no matter what befell them, they would never be on the very bottom. The American caste system, which co-opted this class of white workers nearly from the start, drove such a wedge between black and white workers that there probably are not today in the world two groups of workers with practically identical interests who are kept so far apart that neither sees anything of common interests, Du Bois wrote. These insecurities extend back for centuries. A Virginia slaveholder remarked in 1832 that poor whites had little but their complexion to console them for being born into a higher caste. When a hierarchy is built around the needs of the group to which one happens to have been born, it can distort the perceptions of one's place in the world. It can create an illusion that one is innately superior to others, if only because it has been reinforced so often that it becomes accepted as subconscious truth. Nobody could take away from you this whiteness that made you and your way of life superior, Lillian Smith wrote. They could take your house, your job, your fun. They could steal your wages, keep you from acquiring knowledge. They could tax your vote or cheat you out of it. They could, by arousing your anxieties, make you impotent, but they could not strip your white skin off of you. It became the poor white's most precious possession, a charm staving off utter dissolution. Given that the hierarchy was designed for the benefit of the caste that created it, the basic restrictions upon marriage, occupation, and public gatherings separate the two groups into two self-perpetuating castes in such a way that the white group is assured the higher privileges and fuller opportunities wrote the anthropologists W. Lloyd Worner and Allison Davis of the bipolar caste system, exemplified by the Jim Crow South. This affords the dominant caste a tremendous gain in psychological security as a result of their categorically defined superiority of status. Things began to change in the 1960s when civil rights legislation opened labor markets to women of all races, to immigrants from beyond Europe, and to African Americans, whose life and death protests helped unlock doors for all of these groups. New people flooded the labor pool at the precise moment that manufacturing was on the decline, and every worker now faced greater competition. In the span of a few cruel years, wrote the New York Times columnist Russell Baker in the 1960s of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, he has seen his comfortable position as the in-man of the American society become a social liability as the outcasts and the exploited have presented their due bills on their conscience. Some people from the groups that were said to be inherently inferior managed to make it into the mainstream, a few rising to the level of people in the dominant caste, one of them, in 2008, rising to the highest station in the land. This left some white working-class Americans, in particular those with the least education and the material security that it can confer, to face the question of whether the commodity that they could take for granted, their skin and ascribed race, might be losing value. There had always been a subordinate caste, and everyone knew who the subordinate caste was and had positioned themselves accordingly. Always the Negro was something you had to prove you were better than, Lillian Smith wrote of the white working class dilemma, and you couldn't prove it. No, you couldn't prove it. The beliefs and assumptions had all contributed to a collective madness, and it is that which feeds on half-lies and quarter-truths and dread. Those in the dominant caste who found themselves lagging behind those seen as inherently inferior potentially faced an epic existential crisis. To stand on the same rung as those perceived to be of a lower caste is seen as lowering one's status. In the zero-sum stakes of a caste system upheld by perceived scarcity, if a lower caste person goes up a rung, an upper caste person comes down. The elevation of others amounts to a demotion of oneself. Thus, equality feels like a demotion. If the lower caste person manages actually to rise above an upper caste person, the natural human response from someone weaned on their caste's inherent superiority is to perceive a threat to their existence, a heightened sense of unease, of displacement, of fear for their very survival. If the things that I have believed are not true, then might I not be who I thought I was? The disaffection is more than economic. The malaise is spiritual, psychological, emotional. Who are you if there is no one to be better than? It's a great lie on which their identity has been built, said Dr. Shushrut Jadhav, a prominent Indian psychiatrist based in London, who specializes in the effects of caste on mental health. Thus, a caste system makes a captive of everyone within it. Just as the assumptions of inferiority weigh on those assigned to the bottom of the caste system, the assumptions of superiority can burden those at the top with unsustainable expectations of needing to be several rungs above, in charge at all times, at the center of things, to police those who might cut ahead of them, to resent the idea of undeserving lower castes jumping the line and getting in front of those born to lead. His whole life is one anxious effort to preserve his caste, wrote the Dalit leader Bhimrao Ambedkar of the dominant caste. Caste is his precious possession, which he must save at any cost. When people have lived with assumptions long enough, passed down through the generations as incontrovertible fact. They are accepted as the truths of physics, no longer needing even to be spoken. They are as true and as unremarkable as water flowing through rivers or the air that we breathe. In the original caste system of India, the abiding faith in the entitlement of birth became enmeshed in the mind of the upper caste and hangs there to this day without any support, Ambedkar wrote. For now it needs no prop but belief, like a weed on the surface of a pond. The anxieties of the least secure in the dominant caste are not unlike those of a firstborn child expected to take over the family business. He may have neither the interest nor the specialized aptitude for it, but feels duty-bound, pressured to take the reins, even though a younger sibling, say a sister, is the one who was always good with numbers and has the temperament to run things, but is not considered because of the family hierarchy of who goes first and who inherits what. This creates unsustainable expectations in a culture that proclaims to be egalitarian, but was set up for certain people to dominate by birth. Custom and law segregated the white working and middle classes for so long that most would not have been in a position to see firsthand the headwinds confronting disfavored Americans. The hand of government in the lives of white citizens has often been made invisible and has left distortions as to how each group got to where they are, allowing resentments and rivalries to fester. Many may not have realized that the New Deal reforms of the 1930s, like the Social Security Act of 1935, providing old age insurance, and the Wagner Act, protecting workers from labor abuse, excluded the vast majority of black workers, farm laborers, and domestics, at the urging of Southern white politicians. Further tipping the scales, the Federal Housing Administration was created to make home ownership easier for white families by guaranteeing mortgages in white neighborhoods, while specifically excluding African Americans who wished to buy homes. It did so by refusing to back mortgages in any neighborhood where black people lived, a practice known as redlining, and by encouraging or even requiring restrictive covenants that barred black citizens from buying homes in white neighborhoods. Together, these and other government programs extended a safety net and a leg up to the parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents of white Americans of today, while shutting out the four parents of African Americans from those same job protections and those same chances to earn or build wealth. These government programs for the dominant caste were in force during the lifetimes of many current-day Americans. These programs did not open to African Americans until the late 1960s, and then only after the protests for civil rights. The more recent forms of state-sanctioned discrimination, along with denying pay to enslaved people over the course of generations, has led to a wealth gap in which white families currently have 10 times the wealth of their black counterparts. If you are not black, and if you or your parents were alive in the 1960s and got a mortgage, wrote Ben Mathis Lilly in Slate, you benefited directly and materially from discrimination. The very machinery upon which many white Americans had the chance to build their lives and assets was forbidden to African Americans who were still just a generation or two out of enslavement and the apartheid of Jim Crow. Burdens so heavy and borne for so long that if they were to rise, they would have to work and save that much harder than their fellow Americans. Rather than encouraging a greater understanding of how these disparities came to be, or a framework for compassion for fellow Americans, political discourse has usually reinforced prevailing stereotypes of a lazy inferior group getting undeserved handouts. A scapegoating that makes the formal barriers all the more unjust and the resentments of white working-class citizens all the more tragic. The subordinate caste was shut out of the trillions of dollars of wealth accumulated through the appreciation of housing assets secured by federally insured loans between 1932 and 1962, a major source of current-day wealth, wrote the sociologist George Lipsitz. Yet they find themselves portrayed as privileged beneficiaries of special preferences by the very people who profit from their exploitation and oppression. Once labor, housing, and schools finally began to open up to the subordinate caste, many working and middle-class whites began to perceive themselves to be worse off by comparison, and to report that they experienced more racism than African Americans, unable to see the inequities that persist, often in their favor. Unconscious bias, a mutation in the software. Toward the end of the 20th century, social scientists found new ways to measure what had transformed from overt racism to a slow boil of unspoken antagonisms that social scientists called unconscious bias. This was not the cross-burning, epithet-spewing biological racism of the pre-civil rights era, but rather discriminatory behaviors based on subconscious prejudgments by people who professed and believed in equality. By adulthood, researchers have found, most Americans have been exposed to a culture with enough negative messages about African Americans and other marginalized groups that as much as 80% of white Americans hold unconscious bias against Black Americans, bias so automatic that it kicks in before a person can process it, according to the Harvard sociologist David R. Williams. The messaging is so pervasive in American society that a third of Black Americans hold anti-Black bias against themselves. All racial ethnic minority groups are stereotyped more negatively than whites, Williams said. Blacks are viewed the worst, then Latinos, who are viewed twice as negatively as Asians. There is a hierarchy of rank. What kind of person is likely to carry this kind of unconscious bias? This is a wonderful person, Williams said, who has sympathy for the bad things that have happened in the past. But that person is still an American and has been fed the larger stereotypes of blacks that are deeply embedded in the culture of this society. So despite holding no explicit racial prejudices, they nonetheless hold implicit bias that's deep in their subconscious. They have all these negative images of African Americans so that when they meet an African American, although self-consciously they are not prejudiced, the implicit biases nonetheless operate to shape their behavior. This discriminatory behavior is activated more quickly and effortlessly than conscious discrimination, more quickly than saying, I've decided to discriminate against this person. This is the frightening point, he said, because it's an automatic process, and it's an unconscious process. People who engage in this unthinking discrimination are not aware of it. They are not lying to you when they say, I didn't treat this person differently, and I treat everyone the same. They mean it, because consciously, that is the way they see themselves. These implicit biases shape their behavior in ways they are not even aware of. The research suggests that about 70 to 80% of whites fall into this category. These autonomic responses contribute to disparities in hiring, in housing, in education, and in medical treatment for the lowest caste people compared to their dominant caste counterparts, and as with other aspects of the caste system, often go against logic. For example, a pioneering study by the sociologist Diva Pager found that white felons applying for a job were more likely to get hired than African Americans with no criminal record. In the life and death world of medicine, African Americans and other marginalized people are granted fewer procedures and poorer quality care than whites across every therapeutic intervention, said Williams, who specializes in biases in public health. Of the 60 most common procedures reimbursed by Medicare, he said, African Americans receive fewer procedures than white patients, even though they have a higher rate of illness. The only procedures that African Americans receive at higher rates than whites, Williams said, are shunts for renal disease, the removal of stomach tissue for ulcers, leg amputation, and the removal of testicles. Bias does not contain the damage it inflicts to one group, however. One tragic form of unconscious bias has had the unintended effect of unwittingly protecting the disfavored castes of African Americans and Latinos from a scourge that has brought untold heartache to many white Americans. Empirical studies have found that physicians often disregard the reports of pain from Black and Latino patients, wrongly believing that African Americans, in particular, have higher pain thresholds. This has led physicians to undertreat or to deny pain medication to Black patients, even those with metastatic cancer, while readily prescribing medication to white patients, reporting equivalent levels of pain. The disparity is so severe that African Americans as a group receive pain medication at levels beneath the thresholds established by the World Health Organization. Just as pollutants don't confine themselves to the air around a factory, this single caste inequity has spared no one. The undertreatment of the subordinate caste leaves them to suffer needlessly, and the overtreatment of the dominant caste may have contributed to the rising mortality rate for white Americans who become addicted to opioids. Worse still, society was less prepared for the opioid crisis than it might have been had it not missed the chance to build a comprehensive framework for dealing with substance abuse in the 1990s, when it was the subordinate caste that was in need of help. The crack cocaine epidemic of that era was dismissed as an urban crime problem rather than addressed as a social and health crisis, considered a Black problem rather than a human one. The response was to criminalize addiction when the abusers were subordinate caste, which swelled the rate of mass incarceration, broke up families, and left the country ill-equipped for the incoming tragedy of opioid addiction. Caste assumptions created devastation on both sides of the caste divide and have made for a less generous society overall. Exclusion costs lives, up and down the hierarchy. The physician John M. Metzl, who has conducted research into the health of disaffected whites in Middle America, has measured the life and death consequences of state decisions to withhold benefits seen as helping presumably undeserving minority groups. In the state of Tennessee, for example, he found that restrictive health policies may have cost the lives of as many as 4,599 African Americans between 2011 and 2015, but also cost the lives of as many as 12,013 white Tennesseans, more than double the loss sustained by Black residents. In his book, Dying of Whiteness, Metzl told of the case of a 41-year-old white taxi driver who was suffering from an inflamed liver that threatened the man's life. Because the Tennessee legislature had neither taken up the Affordable Care Act nor expanded Medicaid coverage, the man was not able to get the expensive, life-saving treatment that would have been available to him had he lived just across the border in Kentucky. As he approached death, he stood by the conviction that he did not want the government involved. "No way I want my tax dollars paying for Mexicans or welfare queens," the man told Metzl. "Ain't no way I would ever support Obamacare or sign up for it. I would rather die." And sadly, so he would. Chapter 12. A Scapegoat to Bear the Sins of the World. Every year on the Day of Atonement, the ancient Hebrews took two male goats and presented them before the Lord at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Then the high priest cast lots to determine the fate of each goat. One they would kill as a sacrifice to the Lord to cleanse and make sacred the sanctuary. The other, the scapegoat, they would present to the Lord alive. The high priest would lay both hands on the head of the live goat and confess upon its head all the guilt and misdeeds of the Israelites. All of their sins he would transpose to the goat, and the goat was then banished to the wilderness, carrying on its back the weight of the faults of the Israelites, and thus freeing the Israelites to flourish in peace. The goat was cast out to suffer for the sins of others and was called the scapegoat. This was the ritual, according to Leviticus, that was passed down through the ages, adopted by the ancient Greeks. It survives not only in individual interactions, but within nations and castes. For the ancients, the scapegoat served as the healing agent for the larger whole. In modern times, the concept of the scapegoat has mutated from merely the bearer of misfortune to the person or group blamed for bringing misfortune. This serves to relieve others, wrote the Jungian psychologist Sylvia Brinton Pereira, to free the scapegoaters of their own responsibilities and to strengthen the scapegoater's sense of power and righteousness. In a caste system, whether in the United States or in India or in World War II Germany, the lowest caste performed the unwitting role of diverting society's attention from its structural ills and taking the blame for collective misfortune. It was seen, in fact, as misfortune itself. Thus, the scapegoat unwittingly helps unify the favored castes to be seen as free of blemish, as long as there is a visible disfavored group to absorb their sins. Scapegoating, as it is currently practiced, Pereira wrote, means finding the one or ones who can be identified with evil or wrongdoing, blamed for it, and cast out of the community in order to leave the remaining members with a feeling of guiltlessness, atoned at one. A scapegoat caste has become necessary for the collective well-being of the castes above it and the smooth functioning of the caste system. The dominant groups can look to those cast out as the cause of any fate or misfortune, as representing the worst aspects of society. The scapegoater feels a relief in being lighter, Pereira wrote, without the burden of carrying what is unacceptable to his or her ego ideal without shadow. The ones above the scapegoat can stand purified and united with each other, feeling blessed by their God. In the American South, the designated scapegoat was expelled not to the wilderness, but to the margins of society, an attempted near banishment from the human race. Many men and women in the dominant caste blamed the people they enslaved for poor harvests or for meager returns, called the people who worked as many as 18 hours a day for the enrichment of others lazy, and took out their frustrations on the bodies of those they held captive. The caste system spared no one in the scapegoat caste. When pregnant women were to be whipped, before binding them to the stakes, a hole is made in the ground to accommodate the enlarged form of the victim. A Mr. C. Robin of Louisiana wrote in describing what he had witnessed. The Negro becomes both a scapegoat and an object lesson for his group, the anthropologist Allison Davis wrote. He suffers for all the minor caste violations which have aroused the whites, and he becomes a warning against future violations. After the Civil War, Confederates blamed the people they had once owned for the loss of the war. Well into the 20th century, into the lifetimes of people among us today, lynchings served as a form of ritual human sacrifice before audiences, sometimes in the thousands. People drove in from neighboring states. Schools let out early so that white children could join their parents to watch men in the dominant caste perform acts of sadism on people from the subordinate caste before hanging them from the limb of a sycamore. Lynchings almost always occurred at the hands of persons unknown, performed in a collective way so that no one person could be blamed. Whites were unified in seeing the Negro as a scapegoat and proper object for exploitation and hatred, wrote Gunnar Myrdal, a leading social economist in the 1940s. White solidarity is upheld and the caste order protected. As scapegoats, they are seen as the reason for societal ills. The scapegoats are blamed for a crime rate that they alone do not cause, and for drugs that they are no more likely to use than the dominant caste, but for which they are incarcerated at 6 times the rate as whites accused of similar offenses. Thousands of African Americans are behind bars for having been in possession of a substance that businessmen in the dominant caste are now converting to wealth in the marijuana and CBD industry. In the United States and in India, people in the dominant caste have blamed stagnant careers or rejections in college admissions on marginalized people in the lower caste, even though African Americans in the United States and Dalits in India are rarely in positions to decide who will get hired at corporations or admitted to universities. In the United States, it is a numerical impossibility for African Americans to wreak such havoc in employment and higher education. There are simply not enough African Americans to take the positions that every member of the dominant caste dreams of holding. Notably, while affirmative action grew out of the civil rights movement fought by lowest caste people and their white allies, decades of analysis show that it is white women, and thus white families, rather than African Americans, who became the prime beneficiaries of a plan intended to redress centuries of injustice against the lowest caste people. Scapegoating nimbly obscures the structural forces that make life harder than it has to be for many Americans for the benefit of a few, primarily in the dominant caste. It blames societal ills on the groups with the least power and the least say in how the country operates, while allowing the larger framework and those who control and reap the dividends of these divisions to go unchecked. It worsens during times of economic tensions, when the least secure in the dominant group attacks a group in the minority for structural economic problems that actually harmed both, one social scientist observed, and that neither caused. The human impulse to blame a disfavored outsider group puts the lives of both the favored and disfavored in peril. On an autumn evening in October 1989, a suburban Boston couple expecting their first child that December were driving home from a childbirth class. The husband, 29-year-old Charles Stewart, was the reserved and ambitious store manager at a luxury furrier downtown. His wife, 30-year-old Carol Demiti Stewart, was a petite and gregarious attorney. They had bought a split-level house in the suburbs and had already decided that if that baby was a boy, they would name him Christopher. They were both children of the dominant caste who had risen from modest, blue-collar backgrounds. They had just celebrated their 4th wedding anniversary. That evening, they were driving home through the neighborhood of Roxbury, which had been the landing place for waves of European immigrants, and after World War II, became mostly black, poor, and working class, ravaged by the war on drugs. The husband was behind the wheel of their Toyota and had taken a somewhat circuitous route. At a traffic light in the Mission Hill section, shots were fired, hitting the wife in the head and the husband in the abdomen, both at close range. The husband was in better shape than the wife, and he called police dispatch from his car phone. His wife died at the hospital of the massive wounds she sustained. Their baby was delivered in the wife's final hours, 2 months premature, and named Christopher, as his parents had wished. He lived for only 17 days. The night of the shooting, Charles Stewart told police that a black man with a raspy voice and wearing a jogging suit had forced his way into the car and had mugged and shot them. The tragedy triggered every deep-seated fear and horror in Boston and across the nation. The husband's desperate call to police dispatch aired repeatedly on television, as did video footage of paramedics pulling the mortally wounded wife from the Toyota. Outraged over an incomprehensible tragedy, the city went into action and began a massive manhunt. Mayor Raymond Flynn vowed to get the animals responsible and ordered every available detective diverted to the case. Officers combed Roxbury and stopped and strip-searched every man who fit the description, which meant almost any black man on the streets, hundreds of them. The hunt for a suspect became the near-singular fixation for weeks. The dragnet yielded a 39-year-old unemployed black man with a criminal record, whom Charles picked out in a police lineup. People began calling for the death penalty. For months, officials had paid little notice to inconsistencies in the husband's behavior, distracted as they were by a storyline tailored to their expectations. The night of the shooting, Charles had driven around aimlessly for 13 minutes while talking to dispatch, rather than heading back to the hospital that the couple